This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, you interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In the late 19th century, a group of Mennonites leave Russia for what is now Uzbekistan, driven out by Russian demands that the pacifist group make themselves available for conscription, and pushed forward by prophecies of the imminent return of Christ. Over 100 families travel in a grueling journey, eventually building a settlement and church that locals still remember fondly today. Over a century later, the author Sophia Sommater comes across this story when exploring her own Mennonite heritage, and learns that there's an organized tour. Thus begins a pivot key to her latest book, The White Mosque, combining both historical narrative and travel writing as Mennonites past and present make the journey to Central Asia. Sophia Sommater is the author of the novels A Stranger in Alondria and The Winged Histories, the short story collection Tender, and Monster Portraits, a collaboration with her brother, the artist Del Sommater. Her work has appeared in several Best of the Year anthologies, including the Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy. Sommater holds a PhD in African Languages Literature from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she currently teaches African Literature, Arabic Literature Translation, and Secondary Fiction at James Madison University. Today, Sophia and I talk about both the Mennonite travels to Central Asia, her own journey alongside it, and how that connects to her own experience as someone with multiple backgrounds. So, Sophia, thank you so much for coming on the show today to talk about the White Mosque. My first question is, what actually is the White Mosque? What is the namesake for your book?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. So the White Mosque is the English translation of Akhmetchet, which is the name of a village in Uzbekistan. And this village was the home of a community of Mennonites who had migrated to Central Asia from what was then southern Russia, it's now Ukraine, in the 1880s. And they came and settled in this village of Akhmetchet and had their own community there for about 50 years until 1935. And I've heard a couple of different stories about how the village got that name. But the first one I heard, and the one that really sort of intrigued me, was that the village was named for the Mennonites' church. They had this whitewashed church, so this white building in the village square in the middle of the village, and that to the local population, which was largely Muslim, this church was known as a white mosque.
So, I mean, what actually brought this Mennonite community to Central Asia in the first place? Why did they make this journey and then settle down in this region?
Yeah, there were a couple of different sort of strands that that pushed that to happen. I think, you know, as is the case very often with historical events or life in general, right? It's usually not one cause. It's kind of a number of things come together to cause something to happen. And in the case of the Mennonites, so Mennonites are a peace church traditionally, do not go to war, do not participate in the military. And throughout Mennonite history, this has been a reason for a lot of migrations, because very often historically, whenever Mennonites were being conscripted or compelled to join an army, they would depart, they would leave and move on somewhere else. So they had gone, they had settled in southern Russia because they had been given a promise that they would not have to join the military. However, toward the end of the 19th century, that special right was being revoked. So the Mennonites were leaving that part of the world at that moment. They were leaving their colonies they had set up in southern Russia. Most of them were going west. They were going to the US and Canada. But there was a smaller group who felt that the right thing to do was not to go west, but to go east. And this is the group that forms the subject of my book. And they were led by a very charismatic preacher, a man named Klaus Epp Jr., who prophesied that Christ would return to meet this community in Central Asia on March 8, 1889. So he actually had it, you know, down to a date. This was based on his reading and interpretation of the Bible, especially the Book of Daniel and Revelation. So the first decision, the decision to leave Russia, was, you know, based on something that affected the whole Mennonite community in that region. But the specific choice of Central Asia stemmed from this leader. And there were some other leaders too, who agreed with him, or who also felt that this was the right direction to go.
So I do have a question about your journey and the journey that you made to this part of the world. But I think there's a reading from the book that I think is a really good segue into this question. So I might ask you to read one of the opening passages in your book.
Sure, thank you. So the book is written in a series of short sections, and the one that I'm going to read is toward the beginning of the book, and the title of this little section is Beautiful Error. What brought me here? In a way, I've arrived by accident. I'm haunted by a little piece of history. The story of a small, hardy, stubborn group of people who traveled here more than 100 years ago. I am haunted by a photograph of their church, blanched with whitewash, standing among the poplars of an arid village square. When I first saw it, I imagined its thick walls were made of crystal, that its surface would taste of salt, and that it could contain more than was physically possible, like a word. Because I saw this church in a photograph, I felt I could hold it in my hand. Because the photograph was a century old, I felt I was holding my century, the one in which I was born, the 20th century. Because the church was located in Central Asia, in what is now Uzbekistan, a place I had never seen and of which I knew practically nothing, I felt it was very foreign. Because the church was a Mennonite church, belonging to my own denomination, the faith tradition of my mother's family, I felt it was very close. To be very close to the very foreign is one definition of haunting. As the most prominent landmark of the village where it stood, the church in the photograph gave the place its name, Akhmechet, the White Mosque. To the local population, largely Muslim, the church was a white mosque. Beautiful error, radiant mistake. Whether one is Christian or Muslim or neither, churches and mosques form nodes of powerful feeling. Passions cluster about them. Some perceive them as violently opposed, charged in such a way that they must repel one another. Others would place them together as representatives of the same monotheistic, extremist, world-conquering impulse. But whether you see the forces these places emit as wildly different in character, generating worldviews that can never touch, or whether you see them as unified at a deep level, amplifying one another in a sizzling sibling rivalry, or whether your opinion partakes of both notions, I'm in this electrical storm. My mother's family are Swiss German Mennonites, my father's Somali Muslims. I stand amid this lightning, which here in the 21st century only seems to be growing more intense. And so I wished to go inside the church that was a mosque, its simplicity, its almost blinding pallor. The church crumbled decades ago. It no longer exists. A pilgrimage, then, to error, to ghosts, to the accidental, to the glow.
Well, thank you for reading that passage from your book. This now leads me to my question, which is, you see this church, you hear about this story. Why did you join a tour to go to this part of the world and to see this for yourself?
Yeah, well, I came across this tour. I didn't know that this tour existed before I started writing the book. So it was about, I worked on the book for about 3 years before I actually went on the trip. So by the time I went on this two-week tour of Uzbekistan that winds up kind of, you know, forming the narrative of the book, I had already been digging into research on these Mennonites in the area for a number of years. And then I found that there was actually a Mennonite heritage tour of Uzbekistan, which traced the path of these people, not all the way back from what's now Ukraine, but from Tashkent. So the tour started in Tashkent and then traveled to the city of Khiva, which is the largest city, kind of capital of the province, where the village of Akhmachet is. And the final, you know, stage of the tour was actually a visit to the village of Akhmachet. So, of course, once I found out that there was this tour where I could go to the places where these people had gone, it was like, I have to do this. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the idea that there's a whole tour for this is, it's, I guess me being uninformed, it's not the kind of thing you would think would have an organized tour around it, but there is.
Yeah, there is. And I mean, I just like you, I also didn't expect there to be one. And this is, it's a very interesting tour. It has been going, I believe the first one, it's definitely a 21st century phenomenon. So I think the first tour was around 2007 or 2005, somewhere around there. And the first tour was actually, all the people on that tour were descendants of the Akhmachet Mennonites, of the group that had settled in the village. And they were returning to kind of see where their ancestors had lived. But then there was enough interest within the wider community of Mennonites, of people who are interested in Central Asia, of people who are interested in, you know, German-speaking migrant communities. I mean, it just turned out that there was enough interest to continue doing the trip. And in fact, there's another one happening this fall.
So what are the kinds of people that went on this tour? What were some of the people who joined you on your travels?
Yeah, so there were a number of descendants, a number of people who had family ties to the group. There were other people who were Mennonites from either, you know, the U.S. or Canada, who make a practice of studying Mennonite history. And so they go on various sort of trips and kind of they're interested in any kind of learning experience that puts them in touch with various facets of Mennonite history. There was also someone who was from a society that is interested in German-speaking groups who settled in Canada. So that person was not Mennonite, but was interested in groups similar to the Mennonites, who were a German-speaking group. And then there was me.
So maybe I want to go back in time again into the trip that inspired this tour, which is probably a lot less comfortable for the people involved. But what happens to the Mennonites who then kind of make this, I'm going to use the word pilgrimage. I don't think that's not the right term, but basically make this journey. I assume it's a hard journey. I think many don't make it. What were some of the, historical figures, some of the people that kind of led this journey to eventually found the White Mosque?
Yeah, I mean, this was, so when I first, came across this photograph, and that photograph was taken in 1932 by a Swiss traveler named Ella Maillard, who was traveling in the region and visited Akhmetchet while the Mennonites were still living there. And she actually becomes a character in her own right in the book. I kind of follow her and look into her story. But when I came across that photograph, that was just kind of the surprise of, wait, what? Mennonites in Uzbekistan? I never heard this story. And then when I started researching it, it's such a rich story. It's so full of fascinating topics, which wound up becoming a lot of the material of the book. So there's this whole thing with this preacher, Klaus Epp Jr., and the idea of the end of the world, right? So this is, you use the word pilgrimage. I think in some ways, that's a good term. I mean, a pilgrimage is a journey that has a special significance. It has often a sacred significance, and it is a journey in which, the path is known, right? A pilgrimage is not just wandering around. A pilgrimage, there's a destination and there's a particular structure to that journey. And in the kind of apocalyptic thinking that we see in a leader like Klaus Epp and some of the other Mennonite leaders, apocalyptic thinking is also something where there's a destination. It's a destination in time rather than space, but it is a movement toward the end of the world, which is predicted and is known. So it's also not, that you're sort of wandering in time, or you're kind of like, oh, something happened today, something else happens tomorrow. No, this is a vision that gives you a particular destination and end. And so that was a really fascinating and interesting dynamic, especially because it's one that is very common all over the world, right? Both historically, there have been many different times, many people who have predicted the end of the world, and it's something that's very much still with us. So that became interesting, but then the journey itself was also just, you say it was, it was less comfortable than my, ride on a tour bus, which is certainly true. My journey took 2 weeks. These Mennonites took 2 years to get from their homes that they were leaving to Akhmetchet, where they eventually settled. And they had, every kind of struggle of difficulty, from the heat to typhoid to, smallpox, all kinds of, epidemics they ran into, to just a complete lack of understanding, lack of expertise regarding the landscape. Like, they were trying to cross the desert with horses and wagons. They should never have done that. They should have used camels. And they did learn their lesson, because when they came to a second desert area they needed to cross, they did then they used camels the second time. But there was a lot of just a lot of hardship and a lot of deaths, especially deaths of children. Through that, another element of the story that becomes interesting to examine and think about is just, the kind of perseverance of these people and sort of how to read that from where we are now, you know, because there are different interpretations, you know. Do you read this as fanaticism? Do you read this as resilience? Do you read it as a kind of spiritual commitment? Do you read it as just, you know, just confusion? And there are ways to support all of those interpretations. So, yeah, these are some of the things that the more I looked, the more I found with this story.
And the Mennonites become, well, the Mennonites become this kind of modernizing force in the community. I mean, they can, or they bring new technologies. And I think you draw a comparison between that and how the Mennonite community interacts with the world today. So maybe I'll kind of start with asking kind of the Mennonites get to Apachet and they kind of settle there. How do they interact with the community there? And then how does that compare and contrast to what the Mennonites do today?
Yeah, that's a really big question and takes me a number of sort of chapters to kind of tease out the different pieces of these dynamics within the book. But without being, you know, try to keep it short without being reductive. So how did the Mennonites interact with their neighbors in Central Asia? By all accounts, relations were very amicable. They had a good relationship with their neighbors. In fact, one of the things that was most moving on the trip was to arrive in Akhmachet and to find that this story is still very well remembered in the area. In fact, there is now a Mennonite museum in Khiva where you can go and you can see, and we went into this museum and the team has done an incredible job with things that they've preserved, photographs, and I mean, they have wonderful displays related to the Mennonites in the area, which was very moving because for us coming from, you know, the most of the people on the trip being sort of North American Mennonites, we really didn't expect that there would be that much interest and a kind of sympathy with this story and with these people. In Akhmachet, we met people who they made a display for us of objects that had been given to their families by the Mennonites when they were deported, because they were deported by the Bolsheviks in 1935, this community. And each head of household was allowed to take sort of one large sack of belongings. And so they were just giving things away to, you know, their neighbors in the surrounding area who were not being deported with them. And people have preserved those things and know where they came from. That's one of the things that I found really wonderful about this story is the way that these people, after a huge disappointment, right, because they expected the world to end, they expected Christ to return, and that didn't happen. But really, to me, the story becomes most interesting after that because they didn't leave. They stayed there and they made, they had a community there. Now, how does that relate to the way that Mennonites operate in the world today? I think there are certainly some parallels. There are still, you know, Mennonite communities that make it a point and part of their purpose to be in good relationship with all the people around them, regardless of, you know, what those people, what religion those people practice or what their ethnicity is or what their culture is like or anything like that. But there's also a very prominent missionary history among Mennonites, and that I take that I have a more critical eye toward. And I express that in the book, because one of the characteristics of the Mennonites in Central Asia was that they were not evangelists. They were not trying to convert anybody, and they were not trying to, that was not part of their worldview. And to me, the positive relations that they were able to have with their neighbors stems partly from that, from the fact that they did not sort of take on any kind of missionary outlook.
So I want to talk or ask now about how you see all this in light of your own background. And you are someone of mixed heritage. As you noted in your reading, you are descended from both the Mennonite community, but also a community of Somali Muslims. You, as I said, you have a mixed background. And how do you kind of understand this story and your journey in light of your mixed heritage?
Yeah, this was one of the really interesting kind of transformations for me personally in investigating this history and writing this book, because being mixed, you know, in kind of every way, like ethnically, culturally, you know, two different, you know, religions in my family, I had grown up feeling like just a real weirdo, you know, like just like, where in the world is there a place for such a person? This is such a strange combination of things. And I felt that, you know, belonging was sort of always an issue, like how to belong, how to be part of a community. But in studying this story, I kind of came to the realization that, look, everybody is multiple. Everybody is the result of multiple and varied experiences. And when you think about, you know, what is a self, what is a person, of course, you can think of, and probably the simplest go-to is like, well, what's that person's heritage? And I think that definition of a self has become very prominent in recent times, partly because of the rise of genetic testing, right? So now we have all these tools to find out all these things about our heritage, like I'm 10% this and I'm 15% that. And that is very easy to get attached to. But if you think about who people are, I mean, really, when you find out somebody's, you know, kind of genetic heritage, you've kind of, in some ways, you've just found out like the least interesting thing about that person, right? I mean, who that person is made up so much of what have they read? What are they listening to? What do they think? What do they believe? What do they dream about? And I feel that those things are, you know, those kind of narrative pieces, the person's story of who they are, those things are certainly as important as the genetics. And I feel in many ways, you know, should be stressed over and above the genetics. And if you look at people in that way, you rapidly see that there is nobody whose experience is limited to one particular strand of culture or to the traditions of one particular ethnic group. That's not actually how human life works. And so, you know, by the end of this trip and the end of this book project, rather than thinking of myself as different from everybody else, because, you know, it had looked to me as I was growing up that, oh, everybody has kind of a place to belong and I don't. Now I see that completely differently. And I see that on the contrary, whether people recognize it or not, everybody is multiple. Everybody is varied and has a, you know, a plethora of diverse experiences that go into making up who they are.
You know, I think that's a perfect place to end our conversation with Sophia Sommerter, author of The White Mosque, a memoir. Sophia, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And second, what do you think the next project might be?
Sure. Thank you. So people can find this book really wherever books are sold. I myself am a fan of bookshop.org, which allows, which supports independent bookstores, but you can also find it, you know, at Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all the places. And what's coming up next for me? In the fall, I have a book coming out, which is a collaborative work with a friend of mine, the writer Kate Zambrino. The book is called Tone, and it is about it's about tone in literature and what is tone. And we kind of try to investigate and read a number of different books to study what tone is. And then in 2024, I have a science fiction novella that is coming out that is called The Practice, The Horizon, and The Chain.
Well, I would definitely want to hear more about both of those projects in the future. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia, that's reviews plural, and you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on our fair podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more news on who's coming up on the show, but before then, Sophia, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about The White Mosque.
Thank you, Nicholas.